Hello, and welcome to A History of Japan. Season 10, Episode 14, The Imjin War, Part 4, Stalemate and Withdrawal. In the spring of 1593, a little less than a year after the Imjin War began in June of 1592, the Japanese army had conquered nearly the whole of the peninsula, only to be pushed into its southern portion by armies from the Ming Dynasty working alongside a resurging Joseon armed forces. If this was a fictional story in a fantasy novel, the plucky underdogs would soon drive the invaders out, never to be seen again. The truth, however, is much darker. And the reality for both invaders and invadees was not so cut and dried. After the joint Ming-Joseon army seized Hansong, both sides had good reason to press pause on the war. The Japanese had burned most of the wild grass growing in the vicinity of the capital, making life difficult for the cavalry-heavy Ming army, who needed fodder for their mounts. Likewise, the Korean Navy had been regularly sinking Japanese supply ships, which is part of why they were unable to hold the northern reaches of the peninsula. With both sides suffering supply issues and both having suffered significant losses from the other's victories, what followed was largely a stalemate. However, Toyotomi Hideyoshi was extremely dissatisfied with this turn of events and demanded that a previous defeat be avenged through victory. You may recall from the previous episode that the first siege of Hsinchu resulted in a stunning Japanese defeat in the fall of 1592. The Taiko refused to admit defeat in this war and ordered Konishi Yukinaga to take Hsinchu Fortress. Yukinaga, meanwhile, had been negotiating with the Ming and Joseon commanders and informed them of Hideyoshi's desire for their forces to take Hsinchu Fortress purely as a face-saving measure. The commanders agreed to tacitly allow this seizure and passed orders along advising every other military contingent, both regular and guerrilla, to abandon Hsinchu and relocate to a different area. Most complied, but a few righteous army contingents decided that even allowing a symbolic Japanese victory was a bridge too far. The 4,000-strong Weibyong garrison at Hsinchu prepared to defend it to the last man. In addition to its military fortification, Hsinchu was also a thriving town of 24,000 civilians whose fates would be extremely unfortunate. The Japanese army who advanced on Hsinchu in July of 1593 was around 90,000 strong, nearly their full numbers at the time. This army was determined to undo their previous defeat here, and those who advanced on the walls held wooden shields over their head to protect them from arrows and other projectiles. The garrison used every available weapon, including cannons and fire arrow missile batteries, driving back the initial attempts to scale the walls with ladders by hurling down burning oil and rocks. The Japanese tried using devices called tortoise shell wagons to protect sappers who attempted to remove blocks from the wall to create a breach, but the ground around the walls was mostly dried grass, and when the defenders set it alight, the sappers and their escort were forced to retreat while putting out flames that threatened to consume them. They tried attacking with siege towers only to have those towers destroyed en route by Korean cannon fire. 3 days into the siege, the Japanese attackers resorting to using their civilian hostages. They communicated to the defenders that if they did not surrender, they would execute 10,000 Korean peasants who had been taken prisoner. The defenders refused, and 10,000 were beheaded. The defenders claimed that an enormous Ming army was on its way to relieve the siege and crush the attackers, but this was either a bluff or based on faulty intelligence. The Japanese leaders were aware that the Chinese generals had already written Hsinchu off as a loss and would not arrive to support this bold defense. Making matters much worse for the defenders, a heavy rain began to fall. This meant that their fire weaponry would be rendered useless if the Japanese decided to deploy their tortoiseshell wagons once more to try and break their walls. This is precisely what the invaders did, and in short order, a breach in the wall was made by sappers protected by both their tortoiseshell wagons and local weather conditions. Once it became clear that the wall had a breach, the attackers rushed in to seize the city. The defenders were now almost defenseless, having expended their supply of arrows and mostly possessing wooden implements, which they now attempted to use as clubs against the onslaught of the invading Japanese. There were a few impressive last stands by the beleaguered leaders of the Weibyong, but they were all killed or committed suicide. The civilian population was likewise subjected to indiscriminate slaughter, and although only 4,000 were actually soldiers, 20,000 heads were preserved in salt and sent back to Japan for rewards. Almost no one in the city was spared from the sword, though a group of women entertainers known as kiseng were kept alive on the understanding that they would be entertaining the Japanese. Kiseng are similar to the Japanese geisha, although both are too complicated to describe them as merely prostitutes. In fact, many orders of kiseng did not engage in sex work at all. One of these kiseng, named Nong-e, became a Korean national hero when she lured a samurai general to the edge of a cliff with the promise of sex, and then grabbed him and leapt onto the rocks below, killing them both. She would be later honored with folktales, monuments, and shrines. Although Chinchu had been taken, the victory was extremely costly. The Japanese forces are believed to have lost around 13,000 in the effort, a significant number for an army already demoralized by recent heavy casualties. While Hideyoshi rejoiced that the earlier defeat at Chinchu had now been rectified, military historians who have studied this conflict generally come away with the impression that it was a waste of lives for what was essentially a symbolic victory. The Japanese did not attempt to hold Chinchu, but plundered the fortress and nearby town before returning to Busan. There were no plans for a new campaign, and for the moment the Japanese were isolated on the far southeastern coast of the peninsula. The second siege of Chinchu was not the last time blood would be shed in this conflict, but it was the last major battle of 1593. Throughout the fall and most of the next few years, emissaries were sent between Toyotomi Hideyoshi's court and Ming Emperor Wanli to work out an amicable peace. During these peace negotiations, some minor skirmishes broke out between Japanese patrols and bandit gangs or platoons of Weibyong, but neither side was able to muster a whole new campaign. In fact, from 1594 to 1597, both the Japanese and the Chinese steadily withdrew troops from the peninsula, though the Japanese made sure to keep enough warriors stationed in their meager holdings on the southern coast to discourage any attempt to retake them. Ultimately, though, the Japanese troops were not on a mercy mission to bring enlightenment to an underdeveloped neighbor. The just cause used to support this war was paper-thin, and its prosecution was as merciless as it was horrific. Those who supported the effort were generally driven by greed for reward or hope for future promotion from Hideyoshi, hardly the behavior one might expect from the noble samurai of later legend. The peace negotiations began well enough with the usual polite courtesy from both camps. However, the layers of etiquette, protocol, and deference with which they needed to approach the leaders of both factions inspired some unfortunate misunderstandings. Emperor Wanli of the Ming had been given an overly optimistic version of the war's proceedings by his advisors, being assured that Japan was nothing more than a minor kingdom which had suffered internal devastation because of the war. The negotiators also assured him that Hideyoshi was receptive to becoming the emperor's vassal and restoring Japan's place in the tributary system. This would be a huge accomplishment for the emperor, as Japan had been refusing to comply with regular tribute for nearly 200 years. Meanwhile in Japan, the negotiators dealing with Hideyoshi were likewise going well beyond their scope in describing how eager Emperor Wanli was to put this matter behind him. He was led to believe that the Ming dynasty was on the cusp of surrender, and that they were even willing to name him as their new emperor. He made demands commensurate with these conditions, that a Ming princess be married to Japan's emperor, that the southern half of the Korean peninsula be acknowledged as Japan's rightful territory, and that hostages be sent from the Joseon royal family. I can only imagine how furious leaders on both sides of this conflict became when they received the other's demands. Because of the difficulty of travel, the endless conveyance of messages back and forth, and ritual calendar considerations, it wasn't until 1597, after 3 years of uneasy ceasefire, that it became clear that neither side was willing to acknowledge the victory of the other. Hideyoshi ordered a new campaign, and soon 140,000 Japanese troops were sent to Busan to launch a fresh offensive in this war. The 3 years between the ceasefire and the impasse had not been spent solely on negotiations, however. Hideyoshi was aware of the political divisions of the Chosun court, and thanks to some clever intelligence maneuvering by his generals in the field, he was ready to exploit them. A Japanese fighter named Yoshira had approached Korean General Kim Ung-sa, offering to spy on the Japanese for the Joseon Kingdom. The general agreed, and for many incidents, the intelligence he provided was proven correct. Eventually, the general came to trust Yoshira implicitly. Meanwhile, during the ceasefire, the Japanese Navy received some much-needed upgrades. The larger ships were outfitted with cannons, and additional ships built, swelling the size of the fleet to ensure more efficient transport in the future. The Japanese leaders knew, however, that this would not be enough. The Korean Navy's most able and competent commander, Yi Sun-shin, who was responsible for sinking untold numbers of Japanese ships, needed to be removed. Yoshira came to General Kim Ung-sa and told him that a Japanese fleet would be coming to a certain area and that it could be easily ambushed. This information was passed up the line, and King Sanjo, who was assured of the information's veracity and desperate for a victory, ordered Yi Sun-shin to lay an ambush and engage the Japanese fleet. Admiral Yi Sun-shin, having considered the information, its source, and many extenuating variables, refused to obey this order, saying that the area was infested with sharp rocks, and believing that the intel was unreliable because he didn't trust spies. The response to this was swift. He was imprisoned, tortured nearly to death, and afterward was once again demoted and made to serve as a common enlisted soldier. His replacement, Won Gyun, was inexperienced with naval warfare and was about to pay for it with his life. With peace talks in shambles, Admiral Won Gyun took the entire Korean Navy, about 200 warships, southward to engage the incoming Japanese warriors at sea and stop a new campaign before it started. The Japanese fleet, unfortunately for the new admiral, were ready and waiting for him. The fleet, which the Koreans were about to engage, numbered between 500 and 1,000 vessels. However, they had thus far been obtaining victories through superior ranged firepower in spite of long odds, and so the admiral called for his fleet to attack. The Japanese fleet turned and sailed away from the coast, and the Koreans pursued, firing cannons and trying to chase down the fleeing ships. This was a false retreat, and when they were sufficiently clear of the coastline, the Japanese ships turned and attacked, encircling the pursuing fleet in very short order. They came within arquebus range and rained death upon the Korean sailors, then employed their usual technique of grappling and boarding, slaughtering everyone on board. Shortly after the Japanese turned to attack, 30 of the 200 Korean ships were taken or sunk, and the admiral ordered a general withdrawal, hoping to regroup near the coast. He led the fleet into a strait between the island of Chilcholyang and the port town of Kojae. He appears to have lapsed into a panicked state, as he refused to meet with any of his officers and kept the ships docked in the strait for a week without any orders. The Japanese, upon learning the location of the remainder of the fleet, advanced upon the strait near Kojae from both land and sea. In late August 1597, 500 Japanese warships bore down upon the ships anchored in the strait, along with a land army whose arquebusiers fired onto the ships from the cliffs above. The ships were soon overwhelmed, and the surviving sailors abandoned their vessels and attempted to flee on land. Won Gyun, exhausted and demoralized, sat near a tree to rest. The Japanese army caught up with him and beheaded him. While what was later called the Battle of Chilcholyang was a devastating loss to the Korean defense effort, it was not a complete loss. One of the regional autonomous naval commanders had, near the beginning of the battle, escaped the false retreat ambush and fled for the safety of their base. The 13 ships under his command were now the only surviving remnants of the Korean Navy. Disaster followed disaster for the Allied forces as the Japanese made incursions into southwestern Chawla province, which had so stalwartly defended against their advances during the initial invasion. In late September, about a month after the disaster at Chilcholyang, a Japanese army of around 50,000 marched on the fortified city of Namwon, which was defended by about 6,000 combined Ming and Chosun troops in equal numbers. The samurai demanded that the city's garrison surrender. They refused, and a terrible battle ensued. After an initial test of the city's defenses, the Japanese army bombarded the defenders with cannon and arquebus fire as cover for a siege ramp which their forces were building out of wet rice stalks. The moisture of the ramp prevented the defenders from setting it alight with their infamous fire weapons. As the city wall was overcome by Japanese soldiers climbing the ramp, some members of the Ming Chosun army fled from a north-facing gate, hoping to escape a gruesome fate. The Japanese had placed troops along the northern perimeter of the city, and the would-be survivors were mostly cut down, save for one man, Yang Yuan, a Ming commander who managed to break through the attackers' lines with 100 able fighters. Although he would reach the safety of Hansong, he would later be executed by the Ming court after being blamed for the defeat at Namwon. The casualties for this battle carry a particularly gruesome legacy. Toyotomi Hideyoshi back in Japan was growing increasingly paranoid and infirm. He demanded proof that his warriors were actually killing people in Korea, and after being informed of the difficulty involved in constantly transporting pickled heads back to Japan for viewing, he opted for a more compact solution. It is believed that the Battle of Namwon was the first time when such a substitution would be accepted. Rather than whole heads, noses were taken instead, and sent back to Japan preserved in great barrels of salt water to show the Taiko that the war was proceeding. Over the remainder of the war, at least 30,000 noses from Chinese soldiers and 38,000 noses from Korean soldiers would be sent to Kyoto, and in late 1597 buried under several layers of earth in the shape of a mound. A Buddhist ritual was performed to ensure that the spirits of those whose noses had been sent to Japan would be at rest. While it was originally named Hanazuka, or Nose Mound, its name was later changed to Mimizuka, meaning Ear Mound, though historians generally contend that it doesn't actually contain any severed ears. It still exists in Kyoto today and is often called Japan's least visited tourist attraction. When Namwon fell, the Japanese army opted for its usual tactic of slaughtering every civilian within the city walls right alongside the combatants. Tens of thousands of people were killed, and Namwon's characteristically white walls were stained red from the effort. In spite of this westward stab, the primary target of this campaign was Hansong. With the Korean Navy reduced to 13 ships, the Japanese army had good reasons to be optimistic about their chances this time around. Supply by sea now appeared to be a viable option. However, there had been a few critical developments since the Battle of Chilcholyong. Admiral Wong Gyun's untimely death had shaken things up in the Chosun armed forces, who quickly reappointed Yi Sun-shin as the new commander of the Navy. Amid news of the Japanese army's advance to Namwon and subsequent reports of forces moving toward the capital, however, King Sanjo ordered Admiral Yi to scuttle the ships and bring what manpower remained under his command to defend Hansong directly. In a maneuver I would call extremely surprising for a man who had been tortured nearly to death and removed from this position just a few years previous, Admiral Yi refused this order, writing to the king that he would not be defeated regardless of the relatively small size of his forces. After rallying some of the survivors of the Battle of Chilcholyong and recruiting additional sailors, Admiral Yi's forces swelled to around 1,500 crew members for his baker's dozen of ships. The meager fleet of warships took up position near the narrow Myeongnyang Strait, which runs between the large Chindo Island and the mainland of the southwestern portion of the peninsula. The Japanese fleet sent a few scouting expeditions to the area, hoping to catch Admiral Yi in a surprise attack and end the potential threat to their supply line. These attempts largely failed, and the admiral repulsed the attempted attacks. He knew, however, that a larger attack would soon be on its way. In fact, to a certain degree, he was counting on it. He had not chosen his position at the northern end of the Myeongnyang Strait because it was cozy. The currents to the south of that area were very dangerous, and in some places neighboring currents flowed in opposite directions, making navigation with large, unwieldy ships very difficult. The strait was also too narrow for large numbers of ships to pass through in tandem, making it an ideal choke point. He deployed over 30 small, swift scouting ships to keep him apprised of enemy movements. In late October, they informed him that the large Japanese fleet which they had been monitoring was heading in their direction en masse. The Japanese fleet was composed of over 300 ships in total, with 133 leading the vanguard toward the Myeongnyang Strait. Given the narrow, shallow conditions of the strait, the attackers would have to make do with using only their sekibune, or medium ships, as the Atakebune, large ships, were too big to safely navigate the waters. As the ships approached the Korean Navy's position, Admiral Yi took his flagship forward to face them. The other 12 ships in his paltry armada stayed behind, regardless of his attempts to urge them forward. Many of the crew had survived Chilcholyang and were probably intimidated by the sight of yet another massive Japanese fleet. Still, rather than attempt to force the crews to support his attack or withdraw and have the officers executed, Admiral Yi chose instead to lead by example. As the first few Japanese ships came into range, he fired upon them with his long-range cannons, sinking several of the frontline ships. For a long while, Admiral Yi's flagship was the only Korean vessel engaging the enemy, while the others hung back to see how the battle would go, no doubt ready to flee as soon as things looked grim. As the flagship continued to hold its own against the advancing Japanese, easily sinking their crowded ships which were so closely packed together in the strait, other ships gradually joined in the effort. At some point, the tide shifted, flowing away from the shore and making the waters of the strait even narrower. Japanese ships crashed into one another, some were beached, and many sustained intense damage. Seeing that panic was gripping his enemies, Admiral Yi ordered his fleet to ram the flailing Japanese vessels, sinking 31 in short order and inspiring the remainder of the enemy ships to disengage. The Battle of Myeongnyang was an amazing naval victory which inspired continued resistance from the Koreans against the Japanese invaders. Admiral Yi Sun-shin is regarded by military historians as by far the finest naval commander of his day, and his exploits at this battle were dramatized in the 2014 Korean film Admiral Roaring Currents. In early 1598, a 50,000-strong allied Ming Chosun force descended on the fortress of Ulsan, which had been built by Kato Kiyomasa himself. This initial siege inflicted heavy casualties on the defenders, but failed to take the castle and withdrew when sizable reinforcements arrived. In autumn of the same year, a Ming Chosun army of 30,000 attempted once more to take Ulsan, a long-term siege effort which would nearly stretch into 1599. However, this effort ultimately stagnated, and the Allied force lifted the siege of their own accord in early November. These efforts were mirrored by other similar siege attempts, most of which would ultimately fail, but which would succeed in the overall goal of expelling the Japanese from the Korean Peninsula. What began as a resurgent campaign to seize Hansong was ultimately stymied once more by an unreliable supply line, which was harassed and destroyed by the now confident Korean Navy, as well as casualties mounting from a newly resurgent Ming Chosun alliance. In fact, since June of 1598, Toyotomi Hideyoshi was ordering massive withdrawals of troops from Korea. It seems likely that this was part of a larger withdrawal effort, a tacit concession that this conflict had ended, and the best course of action was to bring everyone home. However, what could have been a smooth, gradual withdrawal without significant casualties was complicated in September of 1598, when Hideyoshi died. His death was kept strictly secret until the last of the Japanese troops could be brought home, for fear that it would embolden the Ming and Chosun. The final battle of the Imjin War was, appropriately, a naval battle. In mid-December of 1598, the remaining Japanese troops were gathered in their few remaining fortresses in the south, preparing to embark for home. Admiral Yi Sun-shin had, by this point, joined forces with a Ming navy, and their combined number was 82. Wanting to prevent a large Japanese fleet from amassing and ending the Allied blockade of Sunchan, the joint Ming-Joseon Navy moved against the Shimazu fleet, who were hoping to link with the ships under the command of Kato Kiyomasa. The ensuing battle took place in the Noryang Strait. It was a bloody affair, with ships being boarded and those on board desperately fighting for their lives amid cannon fire, arquebus bullets, and arrows. As in previous engagements, the Japanese ships were extremely vulnerable in the narrow strait, and the Chinese and Korean ships amassed against them defeated them handily, though not without great cost. In the course of the battle, Admiral Yi was struck by an arquebus bullet. He was taken below decks, where it quickly became apparent that the wound was fatal. He ordered his nephew Yi Wan to put his armor on and keep his death a secret until after the battle had been won. His two sons were also on board the ship, and the three young men were the only ones present when the admiral died shortly after giving his last order. His nephew did as he was ordered, and his sons managed to keep themselves composed through the course of the battle so that no one was the wiser. Of the 500 ships deployed by the Shimazu clan, 200 managed to escape. A week after the Battle of Noryang, the Japanese finally departed for good, boarding ships in Busan and sailing for home shores. The Imjin War was over. What did Japan gain? The long-standing enmity of their closest neighbors, the loss of any chance of future trade with China or Korea, and a reputation for cruelty, carnage, and senseless destruction. The war devastated the Korean Peninsula, who would need decades to recover both economically and socially from an unbelievably dark period. Throughout the course of this four-part series, I have highlighted the brutality and senseless mass murder of the Japanese invaders. However, the Ming army also seized food and other supply from helpless farmers, committed rape and other brutal crimes in the Korean cities that hosted them, and engaged in mass murder of groups of Koreans who had lived under Japanese rule against their will once the Japanese had withdrawn. Unfortunately for anyone seeking a good versus evil narrative to force this entire endeavor to make any kind of sense, the Korean army, especially the Weebyeong guerrillas, also committed atrocities against members of the population accused of collaboration, whether willing or coerced. In one particular incident, they ambushed a Japanese column which was escorting a large company of Korean women who were no doubt intended for sex slavery or other unsavory fate. After they had killed many Japanese soldiers and driven the remainder of the column away, they turned their swords against the Korean captives, saying that they had been polluted by the Japanese. The total casualties of the Imjin War just among Koreans is believed to be over 1 million people. This number includes not only the war dead and the slaughtered civilians, but those who starved when their food supply was requisitioned or destroyed, and other peripheral casualties of wartime. At the beginning of this particular sequence of episodes, I said that I originally planned to cover this war in a single episode. However, it is a trend within Japanese historiography to cover this invasion in only the broadest terms in terse summaries which require very little ink, as though the event was minor both in scope and execution. The ripples of the 16th century Japanese invasions of Korea were felt by citizens of at least three nations for generations thereafter, and would later be seized upon by proponents of 20th century Japanese imperialism. Charting the course of this war has been a deeply disturbing and depressing process. For those of you fair listeners who are likewise disturbed and depressed, I can only offer you my solidarity and commiseration. But when I set out to create this podcast, I was determined not to look away at the more difficult moments, not to ignore the atrocities for the sake of palatability. If these last four episodes have shaken the foundations of your understanding of human nature, you are absolutely not alone. My own have been shaken considerably. Next time we will, thankfully, move on from the Imjin War and set our focus back on Japan throughout the 1590s, where Hideyoshi was still governing domestic affairs amid the invasions of Korea and solidifying power for his successor. Until then, thank you for listening. If you would like access to exclusive bonus episodes, as well as ad-free versions of the regular episodes, please consider supporting this podcast at patreon.com/ahistoryofjapan. ¶¶